Hello, and welcome to Talking in Shul, a roundtable podcast. I'm your host, Tamar Fox, and I've got Zahava Stadler joining us from Toronto. Hi, Zahava.
Hi, Tamar.
And Mimi Lewis is joining us from Somerville, Mass. Hi, Mimi.
Hey.
Before we get started today, we wanted to let you all know that we've decided to wind down the Talking in Shul podcast. We've produced almost 100 episodes over a decade, and a lot has changed for all of us. We're going to record two more episodes in addition to this one, which will bring us to an even 100 episodes. We have really loved making the podcast, and you'll hear more about all of our big feelings in the rest of the pod today and the next couple of times, but we wanted to let you all know. For now, we wanted to tell you about this month. This month, we're talking about building community. It feels like suddenly everyone is talking about building community, and we're talking today about the things we've seen that really do and don't work, what we're hearing about community building, and what we want for our communities in terms of growth and resilience. Oh, Zahava and Mimi, it's so great to see you guys again. And I have so many thoughts about this topic, but I thought maybe we would begin by just saying, like, when you think about a really good community, how do you know that what you're seeing or experiencing is like, this is a really good community? Like, what makes you feel like this community is working?
For me, I think it's authenticity. When I can show up grumpy or like jubilant, when I can invite people over to my home in any state of mess or like, hey, I'm really proud. I decorated. And when people can be vulnerable and authentic with one another in group spaces. I think also like that authenticity for me means that I'm not second guessing. If somebody invites me over, I'm not like, oh, but only, are you sure it's not a burden? Like, my kids are crazy. Like, we don't have to do that dance. If they're inviting me over, they want me over. And if I'm not inviting them over, it's not because I don't love them. It's because we need a break or something like that.
That's so interesting because that vision of community, Mimi, it's, you're talking about drawing from the pool of a community for smaller interactions like one-on-one or friend groups within the community to invite each other over, right? The community doesn't consist of the hangs that you're having in your homes, right? That's pulling from the pool of the community. And so I think when I thought about the question, I was thinking about, okay, when you show up in the communal space, what does that look like? And it's interesting that to me that you went narrower to begin with. Because I think that some of this to me is drawing the distinction between the friend group and the community, right? Some of these things about building community are like, start a book club. And I'm like, is that a community or is that just friends hanging out? Like, what is the line between those things?
Yeah, I guess I'm at this particular point in, we have selected a community to put down our roots. And now I'm like, okay, let me look around this synagogue or this social hall or this like parents bagel brunch. Like who do I want to get to that next level authenticity with? But I hear what you're saying, Zahava. Like, I think actually for showing up to a bigger thing that's not just my friends, I think what I want, what makes a community feel right to me, is that I know I can show up to anything and there will be people there who I, of the bigger community, there will be people there who I want to hang out with.
I think when I think like this is working or this is strong, there's this two-sided vibe about people's participation where on the whole, it feels like people are there because they want to be there, not out of a sense of obligation. Right? Not just like, oh, I need a place to show up on Shabbat morning, but, or whatever the occasion is. But at the same time, people also feel a sense of responsibility toward each other and towards the health of the community. So it's not just, I will only show up when I'm really feeling it. And having those things coexist is tough. And because responsibility and sense of obligation are really close, but not quite the same. And so having a community that's really working, to me, is a place that inspires both that sense of interconnectedness and mutual responsibility, and also is a place where people on the whole are there because they really want to be there.
Yeah. I think I would put it a little bit differently than you, Zahava, but I think it might just be semantics. Like, I really think of a community working when it feels like people are taking care of each other without a feeling of overwhelming burden. It's more of a feeling of sharing, of communal. Like, it feels communal. It feels like people are coming together to do something, and not, and that thing is being together and taking care of each other. So it's not only that, but that is how I know that a community is working, is that, you know, whatever the thing is that the community is trying to do, whether it's like raise children or, you know, do some kind of political activism or do some kind of like exercise or whatever it is, that's one piece of it. But are they also in gathering, however they gather, whatever that looks like, taking care of each other and supporting each other in real ways, like in ways that you can feel in your actual physical life? I felt when I was growing up very held by the community that I grew up in Chicago, and it was a large community. Like, there were easily 10 families that I felt totally comfortable just like showing up unannounced at their house to hang out, and they felt the same at our house. And as a kid, I really only experienced it as like social. But I now realize that as an adult, what was happening, not necessarily in a particularly organized way, was that like people were helping each other do stuff and helping each other through hard times. And it was just, it didn't feel like a particularly distinct action when they were doing that, because it was constant, because it was just like part of every day. And that's really ultimately what I think I have been spent so much of my adulthood trying to foster wherever I am, is a sense of like, let's come together, let's be there for each other. We might also have this other thing we want to do, whether it's have Shabbat services or, you know, keep our children from making us crazy for the 6 hours between Shabbat lunch and the end of Shabbat, or, you know, exercising, whatever it is. But it's like, if it doesn't have a kind of communal care aspect, then ultimately it doesn't feel like anything other than just like a bunch of people in a place.
Well, I think that for me, that raises the sort of order of operations question, which is, I think that we often think of building community around a particular activity or goal. You know, like you said, is it like the people that you exercise with? Is it the people that with whom you are active on a particular political issue, whatever it is? But I think that doesn't become a community until the connection transcends that thing. And it almost feels like the thing is, if what you're trying to do is build community, then the thing is the means to an end. Like, you know, mm-hmm. or community emerges from what used to be the goal. It's like, okay, if we're all going to get together for, you know, for I know people who are involved in the like literal weekly protests in Israel, previously around judicial reform, now around hostage deal, and that people didn't come together to build community. They came together to be active around a particular, very, very salient political challenge. And community has emerged from being the people who show up every single week in the same space, caring about the same thing. And so sometimes I think, oh, I am setting out to build community right now is in and of itself a little bit forced. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say inauthentic quite, but forced, right? Because it's almost like it becomes a community when it transcends the reason you came together.
Yeah, and I think there is a challenge if I'm just reflecting on like the difference between friend group and community. And I think friend group might be what you find when you're just seeking community, and community is what you find when you're seeking some purpose. That you have to find with others, or that you have to do with others. That's interesting. I have to chew on that some more.
Part of the reason I wanted to talk about this particular topic now is because I don't know if you guys feel this, but I feel like this is like very zeitgeisty right now. Everybody's talking in my world about building community. I think a lot of it is because of the political moment that we're in, and people are feeling really scared and wanting to feel like we're creating connections with people in our areas, some people local to us. And I think also a lot of it is because definitely since the pandemic, but it was certainly an issue beforehand, like people have just been really struggling to make and maintain the kind of connections with others that make life manageable. Like, it's not just like that make life sweet. It's like a community where it's like you can just be like, it's not just like a group chat where you can be like, ugh, it turns out I need to have a sheep costume for my kid at school tomorrow. Does anybody have anything I need? Or it's also somebody that you could be like, I am losing it. Can somebody please watch my kids for 2 hours? Because otherwise I'm gonna like go off the deep end. Or like, hey, everybody, I just found out that this cool thing is now available here at this time. Who wants to go with me? Like, those things are just harder and harder for people to access. And so I think people are really looking for, like, how do I get that? I know people are finding their lives are unmanageable without those kind of connections, and they feel stuck on building them. Partially because I think in the past, these kinds of things have happened without people being super intentional about them, or without people realizing that they were being intentional about them. Like, it didn't seem like something that you were doing on purpose. You might not have been able to articulate exactly why you were doing something, but now people have kind of lost the muscle memory and they don't know how to do it. I've seen this in some of my friends, that they really struggle. They don't have that many close friends. They don't have people inviting them over. They don't have a strong community to go to. And a thing that I have really struggled with, and part of the reason I wanted to talk about this, is I feel like I don't have any struggles with this because I have a Jewish community. But short of being like, be Jewish, become more religious, I really struggle to like give people helpful tools to build this kind of community. And I don't think that this is... I think that there are things about Judaism that makes it easier for these things to happen. Like the fact that I don't drive on Shabbat, and I live in a community where there's lots of people who don't drive on Shabbat, means that I live in a walkable community, which is very important to just community in general. Mm-hmm. Like the ability to just literally run into somebody on the street, drop by a friend's house on foot, that really makes a big difference in the ability to build community. And like, there's plenty of like actual urban planning data to back that up. But if you aren't Jewish or are not observant, you don't live in a walkable community, it's so much harder to do so many of the things that I would suggest to do. And I really feel, and like things like Shabbat also really lend themselves to like kind of extended hangs without technology, which I think really builds such strong bonds between people. And it's so hard to get that now, but we have this like built-in once a week thing that allows it. So on the one hand, I'm like, oh my gosh, Judaism, incredible, like community building hack. Just believe in this one theological system. It's amazing.
One weird trick to build community.
One weird trick to build community. There's 613 steps and intergenerational trauma. But okay, so this is my question, is like, I feel like I have an amazing community. How can I extend this to somebody who's like maybe not Jewish at all, or maybe Jewish but like doesn't say to themselves, I want to be involved in a Jewish community? Like, how can we, not to be very businessy, but like leverage these insights to outside the Jewish world?
Okay, I think there are two key elements to what you just said about Shabbat. One is the walkability and one is the no technology. And I think I could take either of them, but I don't know if that they lean in the same direction. On the no technology thing, did either of you read The Antisocial Century? It was a cover article in The Atlantic a couple months ago by Derek Thompson. There are a couple of things in it that really jumped out at me, but one of these comments about smartphones was, I just love this line, it just stuck with me, was, phones mean that solitude is more crowded than it used to be and crowds are more solitary. And that idea, right, that there's much less of a bright line between alone time and out in the world time, mean that neither the introverts nor the extroverts are getting their restorative experiences in the same way, but it means that it is very easy to disengage from your proximate environment. And the things about it that seem daunting don't have to be a big deal, right? It's like, oh, being in a crowd and trying to connect with the people around me, that seems a little intimidating, especially after a few years of being in isolation or being new in a place and lots of relocation or really focusing on work for a while or whatever it is that's pulled us out of our geographic proximity, that, you know, it's very easy to semi-withdraw from that within the public space. And so I think finding spaces or intentionally requiring spaces that don't allow for that, right? I know that, like, I mean, I work in education policy, and like phone-free schools and cell phone policies are a huge, huge deal right now in large school districts, and how people are implementing them, and is like, are you banning them? Are you getting every student a yonder pouch so that they can have their phone but not be able to use it? Like, lots of things are going on. But I, as much as I don't want to over attribute our present moment to cell phones per se, I do think that it is a hump to get over. And the geographic proximity thing, the thing that it makes me think of, actually, if you're not going to like throw in your lot with us and come to shul, and plenty of observant Jews have also stopped coming to shul in the last few years, for what it's worth, during and post COVID, but I kind of feel like we might need to lean into public libraries really hard. Like, as an institution that is built around a geographic proximity, that has community events, that I think we kind of need to make libraries cool again. Not that libraries are uncool, but my point is they're not hip, right? it doesn't feel like where the cool people are going of an evening. And right. I feel like it could be. In like 2016-ish, James and Deborah Fellows came out with that book, Our Towns, which was about thriving towns around America and what the kind of secret sauce was. And I feel like there were three themes of that book, one of which was libraries are awesome and we should notice more. Like, libraries are awesome and we should notice more. And I feel like they could be the secular shul for this purpose.
I love that. It's interesting. I think in addition to my shul community and my friend group, the other like quasi community that I find myself a part of is this universe called the Moms of Camberville. And there are like, for each there are age-based cohorts, then there are like affinity groups, and there are groups where you ask questions about particular topics like career or fashion or whatever, travel. And in some ways,
what is the, what's
it's Facebook?
It's Facebook.
It's all Facebook. There was an interesting discussion across many groups in the past few months about, should we leave Facebook? And I think people were really not excited about that because this allowed, first of all, there's so much like a decade of like history and conversations here to learn from and search through. But also if some people were going to leave and go to a WhatsApp or a Blue Sky, but not everybody was going to leave, then we would be missing so much of what the community is. But I mentioned this. I know that there are many downsides because we're not, like, there are meetups that happen for, like, smaller things, but we're not all actually seeing each other in person. And so that can mean that, you know, microaggressions or people, like, bullying others like does happen very rarely. And it's a pretty amazing community where people are saying, hey, I found out about this cool thing. It's in 2 hours. Does anybody want to go? Or, you know, I'm going to share this really scary thing that happened to me, and members of the community are reaching out to support one another. We do have like some proximate base so that we are sharing locations, we're sharing landmarks. And there's the opportunity at times to meet up. But I hear you, Zahava, on needing tech-free to really encourage people to engage in the present moment. And I feel like we would be missing something if we didn't also mention the communities that can be created over technology and social networks.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I have in the past been like, I was thinking recently that there's been so many eras of my life where like there was like an email list or a Facebook group or something that was like a really big piece of what I thought about. And like a big piece of my day was like reading whatever was going on in this group, this like online community typically, and then being a part of whatever that conversation was. Like I can think of five like different eras of my life where these things were a really big part of my daily life, but now it's and now I don't really have those because I've basically exited Facebook. I'm on Instagram, but Instagram groups aren't really a thing, and most email groups have really gone away. I'm on some WhatsApp groups, but they're just not as active. And I do feel a little like, I don't have a good place to go anymore to be like, I need a sheep costume in the next 5 hours. Like, who can help me? I don't really have that and I miss it. But I also felt like, frankly, all of those communities ended pretty much in like a real shitstorm. And I don't miss that. I mean, honestly, yeah. Sometimes it was kind of like fun popcorn eating emoji to watch things go down, but not good. And I think that part of the reason that they all end in this kind of epically bad fashion is because of bad behavior that people are comfortable with in online spaces that generally they wouldn't put up with in the same way in real life. But it's absolutely true that there were like years of my life where buy nothing was such an important part of my day. And it was like, mm-hmm. I would spend hours cleaning out the kids' whatever and put a bunch of stuff on buy nothing. And then I would give something away to another family and they would be so happy and I would be so happy. And I like picked up my daughter's birthday presents multiple times from other people from buy nothing and it made her thrilled and I spent $0. And it's like, I have such fondness for those groups, and also they all ended in such unnecessary drama. So
yeah.
Was that community though? I mean, you know, when we're talking about like you come together around something that's a means to an end and then it transcends that and then you wind up being this sort of mutually supportive, interconnected group of people that are just connecting on the basis of being people. And I don't know. To me, things like Buy Nothing groups have kind of come up because of the weakening of proximate community. It's like, instead of just having a neighborhood full of people who you actually know, who you can say, oh, my kid is growing out of this size and I see your kid is growing into this size. Can we pass along our you know, our size 3 clothes to you? Like, instead, things are sort of mediated through these more formal structures because we don't have that. It's like in the absence of the village, we funnel through this, you know, this intermediary thing.
I think that's correct, but I will say that I think the advantage of those kind of groups is that you can scale them up very quickly. So you can suddenly have 500 people in your neighborhood group, in your Buy Nothing or whatever. And so if you, I don't know why I have fixated on the sheep costume, but let's just go with it. If you need a sheep costume, like if I was just hitting my community of people I know, the chances that there's somebody that have exactly what I need are relatively low. But if I scale it up to anyone who happens to be able to join this, the chances are higher. So there's like real benefit in that you can reach more people faster. It's just that you, the ties to them are looser. And that's why you might feel comfortable saying something kind of nasty in a group like that, which you wouldn't say in a room of your best friends. But you're like, well, I don't know who this person is. And she, you know, put her like anti-vax onesie on here. So I'm going to like put something nasty back to her. And it's like, I don't know, maybe if that woman showed up at your like playground and her kid was wearing an anti-vax onesie. Oh God, I hope that doesn't even exist. These are all stupid ideas from my
That definitely exists, Tamar.
If somebody showed up to the playground wearing an anti-vax onesie, you might just be like, well, I'm not going to talk to that person. Or you might be like feeling brave and be like, I'm so curious. Like, I would love to hear how you came to that and like try and build a connection with them if you're feeling like a real tzedeket that day, I guess. But like, you're not, if they just like post it on your Buy Nothing group, you're going to be like, what a loser.
This is exactly the, okay, so I said there are a couple things that jumped out at me from this Atlantic cover article, The Antisocial Century. The other one is exactly this, which is that So he quotes a fellow at Brown named Mark Dunkelman, who says, home-based, phone-based, I guess internet-based culture has arguably solidified our closest and most distant connections, the inner ring of family and best friends, and the outer ring of tribe, so linked by shared affinities. But it's wreaking havoc on the middle ring of familiar but not intimate relationships, like the people around us, the people that would once have constituted sort of the literal village. He says, the middle ring is key to social cohesion. Family teaches us love, tribes teach us loyalty, but the village teaches us tolerance. Online, you might write someone off as a political opponent who deserves your scorn, but at a PTA meeting in a gym full of neighbors, you bite your tongue. And then as the year rolls on, you actually get to know them, right? The idea that we have access to our closest people constantly, and we have access to these affinity-based contacts that we otherwise would not have been able to find at all, but that we're losing, there's like a missing middle there, was a very powerful idea to me. And I was thinking about it because, like we said, I'm the kind of Shomer Shabbat that means that I need to be walkable from my shul. I actually do know lots of people in my immediate area. And yet, if I were to think how many people on my physical street I don't know, it's a majority of the houses, right, where I don't know the family that lives inside. And that's kind of alarming when I stop to think about it.
You just haven't found the right Facebook groups. I'm joking. But I think, Tamar, you were asking, like, where can people start with building this community? And I was thinking, actually, of the, there's an email list. So it's, but it's an email list of people on my street, which is a 2-block street. And I find that, you know, everybody always signs off with what their number is. And then it means that when you're taking a walk, you're like, oh, are you Melissa? I love, you know, whatever, or thanks so much for suggesting. And you know, that then you can start conversations about like a community yard sale or what was that scary sound that can bleed into the real world without you having to go very far at all. That also has its, like, you know, fiery ends for some people. I'm thinking of, like, not patch.com, but there's some neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. What's it called?
Some app.
Nextdoor?
Nextdoor.
Yes, Nextdoor. I know there can be a lot of drama on Nextdoors.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that we're kind of assuming is that that you are surrounded by people that you actually do want to hang out with, potentially. And I think, like, one of the things that's complicated is if you don't live among people who you feel really excited about hanging out with, because maybe they are very politically different from you, or you're really shy, or, you know, you happen to live in Colorado and you don't like hiking or whatever. I think that is really like an added level of difficulty. And another added level of difficulty is if, like, you're really trying, but you have, like, really crappy neighbors who are really unpleasant, or just not, you kind of feel like you're getting stonewalled from the people nearby. I think those are all really hard. I have been thinking about how I feel that the best thing that I can do when I want to be in community for others, like, basically, unfortunately, I think the answer for me when I want more community is that I feel like I have to do more first. Like, if I want people to be around for me more, then I feel like it's time for me to step up my game, and I have to be there for others more, which is not sometimes it feels not possible. You know, like you might just be going through something where it's like, I have zero extra bandwidth. And it's, to me, this feels like the real catch-22 of all of this. It's like, when you need community most is when you are least able to begin building community. It's usually when you have like the least bandwidth for the kinds of work that it takes to really get something going. Because I think the way that you really get something going, and the reason that Jewish communities can be so strong, is because of the regularity. So whether it's Shabbat Friday night or Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon at a playground or at a nature preserve or on Rosh Chodesh, if you do something very consistently, it means showing up every single week or month, even if you don't really feel like it, then eventually, like, the reliability of something builds a group of people that are feel more connected to each other. But it really takes time and investment. And it's hard. It's just not something that you get quickly. And the other thing is putting yourself out. Like, you said inviting people over, even if I don't feel like my house looks that nice. And that's like such a key part of it. But it's really just about like inviting others to do stuff and being comfortable when they say no. And doing it consistently. And I think that that is also like, it's not fun to hear that when what you feel like you need is more care from others, to be like, ugh, what I have to do is care for others. But it really is, it's a way of training. I mean, I don't see it this way when I'm doing it, but I think it ultimately is a way of like training people to be like, this is what it means to be community, is like we help each other out. I think about like, you know, I live in a house where when packages get delivered, if they sit out for a long time, they're likely to get snatched by someone. And so like my neighbors are very much like, if one of us gets a notification that we got a package, we might like text someone and be like, oh, hey, are you home? Can you grab this for me? And it's like not a big deal to do that. But it's so, if you're home, it's like literally stepping outside and grabbing something. I often don't even have to literally leave my stoop to do it for someone else. But it means that like money that they spent isn't getting taken. So I think that that is really important. And I have become known as like, my partner and I both work from home. So we're like home all the time. So if somebody delivers a package, like I can grab it for you almost certainly. And it's like, honestly, everyone on my block loves me because I will grab your package. And suddenly if I need something, people are like, oh, for sure.
I owe you one.
Right. But it's not really about owing. It's just about a sense of like, oh, I will help you with this. So that makes other people feel like, well, I should help her with that too. Like I can. I don't want it to make it seem like transactional, because it doesn't feel transactional. The goal is actually to get it to feel like it supersedes transactional and just becomes natural. But ultimately, somebody has to be the first one to do it. And oftentimes you have to do it a few more times than you might think before it starts to feel like you get the feeling of like, oh, we're in this together.
It's funny because I'm such an institutionalist. Like when I was thinking about this topic in advance, I was very much thinking about, you know, the formal structures, the buildings, the like, the shul, the community center, the school, the whatever it is that provides the framework for community. And one of the things within that I was thinking about is the way, I think especially this happened during the COVID closures, it takes more for people to come out to something, and people are looking for something more tailored to what they want. That, you know, within my shul, there are now 5 different services on Shabbat morning, and they all feel sparse. But everybody's going to the one that is most closely tailored to their exact needs. And I get the sense that people are just less and less inclined to show up to a space that isn't specifically designed for them. Because I think, Tamar, one of the things that isn't like, I need to extend myself, even though I don't feel like I have the bandwidth, in order to sort of be part of a thing in which people extend themselves for each other. Like, I think that is true. But I think one thing that could be more immediately mutually beneficial is just the creating of more touch points. Like, if what you're feeling is a sense of disconnection or isolation from community, and there is a structure within which you could slot yourself, right? If you belong to a something, fill in the blank on the institution, you can become a person that plans a few events, that, you know, convenes some of the get-togethers, whatever it is, to create the touch points. Yes, it's effort, but it also will fill the need for you at the same time as it creates that for other people. But it requires there to be that kind of pre-existing framework. Otherwise, it's a much, much bigger lift.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, like, if you need community, the fastest thing to do is join one that already exists, where it's like, mm-hmm. it's fully formed and you just need to show up. And I mean, and that is like ultimately how I got my community, is I showed up to one that already existed and then I helped build it bigger. But like, it didn't start out at zero. It started out with a fair number of people I knew and liked. But I have also absolutely had the experience of like showing up in a place where I know exactly 0 people and being like, well, I've chosen this group, you'll be my group. And just being like, I'm coming to all of the things that are on your calendar, and after a week, I will have my new friend. And that works. If you commit, you can usually do that. But it does mean that, like, you still have to find whatever institution it is that has the events that you can go to. And then the hardest part, you have to actually go in person.
It's interesting to think about this conversation. I'm remembering several years ago when we were talking about shul shopping. Because I think one of the challenges I feel in the Boston metro area is that when it comes to shuls, but it's probably true for other communities too, it's like, well, actually, if this shul isn't totally meeting every single one of my needs, especially since I do drive on Shabbat, like, maybe I should go to that other place where the other cool people are going. And I've had this conversation with many friends. Like, I actually think, even though we would drive on Shabbat, there is a value to like choosing the one that's closest to you, because that supports your regularity. It's just like removing one friction point. And for my husband, my family and me now, like, the fact of the walk to shul, yeah, we would drive, and sometimes we do if the weather's really bad, but the fact of the walk is part of the experience of it, and we wouldn't get that if we chose a place that was further away. But I guess the point I started with was like just the overwhelming choice that we have as consumers, even consumers of community, then kind of holds people back from making that commitment and being regular if there are other places they could go and choose not to.
Well, I also think this is not a part of community that anybody ever uses as a selling point, but it's really important. And it's kind of going back to what you were saying earlier, Zahava, but a big part of community is being in community with people who you're like not huge fans of. And you're like, this person's kind of annoying, but they're in this community and I have to deal with them. Or like, this person always asks a question at the Q&A that is not a question. It's actually just a story about their grandson or whatever. But like, I'm just gonna, like, I have to learn to live with them. And I think that is really important. And it means a level of discomfort that is something that you get used to, where it's like, I don't actually need every single thing in the space to be catered to my needs. Like, it may be that I am just not willing to daven with a mechitza, and that's where my red line is. Or I am not willing to daven, I don't like cantorial music, or I don't like going to shul on Shabbat day, but I definitely want to go on Friday night. Or I don't want to go to services ever, but I want to go on a, like, to a Rosh Chodesh group or whatever it is. I think it's fine to have, like, your red lines, but also to understand that, like, being in community sometimes means being around people who are really annoying, or it mean, and it means putting yourself out there. It means sometimes making the soup for somebody else, or, you know, sending the intro email to somebody new and feeling weird about it, or whatever. It sometimes means things that we don't like, but that's part of the value, is that, like, yeah, you get to be in the community, even if sometimes you're a little annoying. We're not just going to, like, kick you out. And we take care of people, and that's so valuable. And I feel like we're just noticing it now even more, how much, like, we need each other. We've spent all this time kind of, like, distancing ourselves from each other in a lot of ways, and we're now realizing how much that has eroded something really vital that we weren't even super aware of while we were experiencing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in this moment, like, this world moment. I think we're in this world moment where disagreement feels incredibly high stakes and is incredibly high stakes, and that there are lots of points of contention right now that feel like something I don't want to get past. I actually gave a Dvar Torah about this on Simchat Torah at my shul this year, about the, I wasn't planning on bringing this up, so now I have to try and dredge this from you know, the recesses of my memory, but the idea that at the beginning of Yom Kippur services, the community gets together and says, Anu matzirim lehitpalel im ha'avaryanim. We agree to pray along with the sinners. And this, like, very fraught we, like, are we not the sinners? We're going to spend the entirety of Yom Kippur talking about all the sins we've committed. Like, who's the we in this sentence? Who's the they in this sentence? Is this an inclusive statement or an exclusive statement? And one of the things that I wanted to say about it was that the choice of the word avaryanim to mean sinners is not incidental. It's not the most common word we use to mean sinners. And, you know, we have other words for sin that are more common in the Yom Kippur service, like chet and pesha. And whereas avera is not, like, the one that comes over and over in the service, the word for sin that shows up in this context. But there's sort of a literary reading, like, avar is the root word that means, like, to cross or pass. You use it for passing the salt and crossing the street in Hebrew. But an avaryan is the kind of sinner that means, like, a line crosser. Like, I've set up a boundary and this is my line and you have crossed it. And those are the people with whom we are agreeing to pray. That there is this notion that, like, it's not a binary state where you are either an avaryan or you're not, right? Like, that there are ways in which I am an avaryan to you. I've crossed some important boundary to you. And there are ways in which you are an avaryan to me. And that we have really high stakes disagreements. We drew those lines for a reason, and actually those divides may be unbridgeable, but they are divides that exist within a people, within a community. And that's what we're saying. Not that we erase the line, we don't think it's important, we don't think it's necessary, we shouldn't have drawn it in the first place. Like, the very notion of being in a Varian implies that the line was there and it was firm. And yet, we're all going to pray together. And I, and you know, maybe that's something we can only muster on Yom Kippur, but that strikes me as a community ideal.
We have to find spaces in libraries to give Divrei Torah. What's the, I guess it's just a talk. It's just said like a workshop. I'm all in right now on libraries as the secular shul. Zahava, I want to think more about that. Especially since I have a friend who's really, who works for a library system and keeps telling me about how they're the solution to so many ills.
They are. Libraries are amazing. I feel like I keep getting content geared, like sent to me in various algorithms that's like about building community. And I'm always like, ooh, and then I click in and it's always stuff I'm already doing, which is not to say that I could not be doing more. I definitely can, but it is to say that like the people for whom these articles are written are not me. Like, they are people who really are not plugged into a community the way I am. And one of them was that I read recently was like, you know what you should do is just make a big pot of soup and invite your friends over. And like, and I was like, that's very funny because I am having a soup party where everybody brings a different soup and there's a soup competition. And I was like, not only am I already doing this, but A, it's the second annual I Will Always Love Soup party, and B, it's like literally to the nth degree. I was like, this is really not
helpful.
Giving me what I need, which is like, how do I level up? So anyways.
Because you need articles not on creating community, but on strengthening community in a way.
Yeah, I want articles on strengthening community and on, oh God, I hate that I'm about to say this, but scaling community. Like making it so that a community can be not just like made bigger, but like, I don't know. I don't know enough about this to say if this is really the model I want, but you know how like sometimes in churches they have like little church groups within the like big mega church? Like, I feel like you sometimes have that in Jewish communities where you'll have like a big community of people who like go to this institution, and then there's like little groups that just happen to form, but I don't think they're generally intentional. And I don't know how, and what I think would be great is honestly if some of the lessons of strong communities that I see in my Jewish community could be expanded to, frankly, non-Jewish folks in my neighborhood community and in my city community who I think really need the connections and strength that comes with being in a strong community and don't really have a good way of plugging into it. Mm-hmm. That's what I want, but I don't know how to do that. If you know how to do that, tamar.fox@gmail.com.
Can I tell you the article I want?
Yes.
I want the article on how to create more mutual responsibility in your community so that we feel called upon to show up, to take care of the space, to take on the kind of shitty jobs of like being a board member or showing up early to whatever it is.
I do think I want to put in a plug for the book that we discussed a couple of years ago, Warm and Welcoming, which was co-edited by friend of the pod, Miriam Steinberg-Egith, because I think there actually is some really great material in there on the things that the sort of the nuts and bolts of making your Jewish community good at a lot of things. And I think revisiting that would actually be great. I think also there's a degree of being a board member is not only a shitty job, it also often, and speaking as somebody who's in like year 5.5 of shul board membership, it also just often feels like a bad way and a bad forum for making a difference, right? That sometimes the existing modes of involvement are not helping you build community in the way that you want. Like you showed up to strengthen your community and somehow it isn't working. And so some of this is about the institutions becoming a little bit more receptive to different kinds of involvement. And that's a little bit of reflection on, am I one of those gatekeepers? What does this look like? So there's a lot going on in the layers, and sometimes it depends how heavily institutional is your institution. Mm-hmm.
I feel like sometimes it's like so great to just plug into something where everything is already underway and you can just go with whatever the system is. But then when you realize that the system is awful, it's like, wait, can I say this system is terrible and we should change it? Or is that going to get me kicked out of this group because they love this system or they just could never dream of some other system? It is really a hard spot to be in. And it's a spot that like everyone is in at some point with whatever group that it is that they love, where you'll be just be like, wait a minute, this isn't the smart way of doing this. And then you have to decide if it's like appropriate and reasonable and likely to succeed if you step in and want to try things differently.
It's a tough spot.
All right. Well, we want to hear about your community tricks and tips and pitfalls. I personally just want to know. But also you could let all three of us know. But I'm just going to give my personal email because this is we're closing in on the end of the show. So tamar.fox@gmail.com. All right. It is time for our endorsements. I am excited. Mimi, hit me with your endorsement.
Well, ladies, I wanted to let you know that I have joined the club of Megillah readers. So we're recording this at the end of March, and for the first time ever, I read some verses of Megillah, and I want to thank you both for recommending the Jofa Megillah app. It was a real game changer for me as I was trying to like toggle between so many different websites and recordings, and I really enjoy. I only read 4 verses, so this is baby, but I read the first 4 verses, and so I felt like I really had to start it off strong. I was super proud, and I like can't wait to someday be like Perek Aleph, call me, I'm on it. So it was really fun. And thank you for that recommendation. And the other thing that I want to recommend, I realized that in addition to being in Jewish community spaces, I didn't realize. I always knew I loved singing in community. And so we have a Malava Malka once a month at my shul at the end of Shabbat, just like ushering out Shabbat together in music. But I wanted something else a little bit more intimate. So I gathered my group of friends from within my community, and I did a text study on Joey Weisenberg has a new album called Sela, and there's actually on Safaria a link to it, a source sheet for his lyrics, and it brings in a few other sources. And it was just really fun and nerdy, and it filled my heart and made me so happy. So I'm excited to share that with all of you.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, Zahava, what do you got?
So I have two recommendations, one very earnest and one super not earnest. So
super not earnest, like sarcastic.
Well, so YouTube has started recommending to me the stand-up routines and also crowd work of Gianmarco Soresi. Are either of you familiar with this comedian?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. No, Tamar, you've shared him on Instagram before.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm just behind the plate because I'm not on Instagram. But he is a Jewish comedian, like very strongly culturally Jewish. His mother is Jewish. His father is non-Jewish Italian. A lot of his stand-up is crowd work, which isn't, you know, sort of planned, but he's like got a very self-deprecating Jewish humor, and often kind of a dark humor about anti-Semitism, which sounds like a downer, but I promise it's not. And it is like unusual, I think, for me to recommend something that is so frequently foul-mouthed and like not particularly clean, but also very funny. And this is, I think, kind of as irreverent as my taste gets. So recommending his stand-up, and I'll put a link to his YouTube channel in the show notes. And if someone other than me would like to put a link to his Instagram in the show notes, feel free. And then my earnest recommendation, since we are now in the run-up to Passover, is I wanted to share a short reading that I have used at the Seder in the past, that I think I found originally on Ritual Well, which is where I was able to pull it back up now. It's by Rabbi Helen Plotkin, about whom I know nothing other than this particular piece of writing. And it's called Breaking the Middle Matzah. So I think Yachatz, step three of the Seder, is not usually one that gets like top billing. But she has this fantastic short reading about this. I'll read just like a couple of snippets from it, not the whole thing. It opens, the entire Seder takes place between the two halves of a broken matzah. So first we acknowledge that the center does not hold. The middle matzah is broken. The larger half we put away for later, it is out of sight and out of mind. What is in our hands now is the bread of impoverishment. We recognize that our need for redemption is great. We are enslaved and dragged down. But like the Israelites in Egypt, we are no longer stuck in the mud. We are standing in the doorway. We are on our way somewhere. We have a history and a future. We begin with this bread of poverty, but before we end our Seder, we will eat the other half too, the bread of redemption. And there's more there about kind of the symbolism, but I think the idea of starting with brokenness and having the vision of redemption and what it looks like to sort of traverse that metaphorical Seder in a moment where things feel pretty broken, it came back to me this year, and I wanted to share it with you all.
Love that.
That sounds so good. But I definitely thought that the comedian was the earnest one. And I was like, where is she going? Okay, I have just one endorsement this time. Everybody clap for me for like really restraining myself.
I was waiting for five. We've been on a break for a while.
My endorsement is this book. It's called The Many Lives of Anne Frank by Ruth Franklin. And it is about Anne Frank, and it divides her life up into the different periods of like her childhood, when she lived in Amsterdam, when they were in hiding, what happened after she was in hiding, and then her legacy. So the initial publishing of the diary, like the editing that her father did, it's so fascinating. It's incredibly beautifully written. I learned so much. I really knew a lot about Anne Frank already, but I still learned an incredible amount. It also made me, this morning I was looking, reading through the critical edition of Anne Frank's diary, which is just an fascinating thing to look at, because I don't know how much of this is known by everybody, but essentially she wrote a diary. Then while they were in hiding, they heard a story on the news. One of the, I think the queen of the Netherlands said, or maybe it was the king, was like, please keep notes about your experiences during this time for a future, for future historians. And she decided that she was going to rewrite her diary for a historical audience. And she did. So she rewrote most of it. And then that was, so there were two versions to begin with. And then after the war, when her father returned, he got the diary. It was missing some sections of the kind of her rewrites were missing. Some of them were missing. And then he made some kind of like some relatively minor changes, things that he took out. There's a lot of ideas about things that he took out that aren't actually accurate. And so then the published version is kind of a little bit of a combination of her original real diary, her rewriting of that diary, and then some editing to create this version that people have generally have experience having read. So I've been looking at the critical edition, which is really fascinating. But this book, The Many Lives of Anne Frank, is so good. And I'm going to read you guys two separate paragraphs from it, just to kind of like show a little bit of some of the crazy things that happened in this book. In a 1950 article titled The Restricted Market, an allusion to the phrase restricted clientele, which was advertising code for hotels that excluded Jews and blacks, the writer Meyer Levin argued that such concerns about Jewish books were preventing the publication of Anne's diary in America. The author of some half dozen books published in the 1930s, primarily on Jewish themes, Levin also worked as a journalist with assignments ranging from reporting on the Spanish Civil War to writing film criticism for Esquire. His audience, as he told a friend, was, quote, faithful but not too numerous. He often struggled financially. Part of the reason for his lack of popularity, he came to believe, was that his writing was seen as, quote, too Jewish. An editor asked him to diversify the Jewish characters in one of his novels to make it more representative of America. When he was at Esquire, the magazine received complaints that it published too many leftists and Jews. The editors responded by running his pieces under the byline Patterson Murphy, prompting a quip from Ernest Hemingway, a friend of Levin's, quote, the hand is the hand of Meyer, but the foreskin is the foreskin of Patterson Murphy. An amazing, amazing joke from Ernest Hemingway referencing a biblical story. Like, everything about it, fantastic. This is a much more serious but fascinating piece. So they're talking about the actress who played Anne Frank's mother in the Broadway production, who then is going on. The Broadway production has closed, but they're filming a movie of it. Schildkraut would reprise his stage role in the film. So would Gusti Huber, the actress who played Edith, even though disturbing information had turned up about her activities during the war years. Born in Vienna, she had immigrated to the United States in 1946 and married radio executive Joseph Besch, a former captain in the U.S. Army, who claimed she was the first Austrian actress to be cleared by the American military government. While the play was still in rehearsals, Kermit Blumgarten received a letter from German-American actress and sculptor Lada Stavisky, alleging that Huber was a Nazi sympathizer who had been a personal friend of Goebbels. In interviews with the American press, Huber claimed that she had refused to join the Nazi party and had once been arrested by the Gestapo for cursing Hitler, According to Herbert G. Luft, a journalist for the American Jewish Ledger, this was all fiction. Quote, in 1943, while the real Mrs. Frank remained in constant fear for the lives of her dear ones, Gusti Huber charmed the Germans in a movie entitled Gabriel Dambrone. In 1944, when the Frank family was shipped off in sealed cars, Miss Huber amused the citizens of the Third Reich, Luft alleged. The only person who seemed to be concerned about this was Meyer Levin of the foreskin, who circulated information about Huber's Nazi past to journalists covering his lawsuit. Huber's bio in the playbill for Anne Frank ends in 1938. On her death in 1993, the New York Times obituary was silent on her wartime activities. So this book suggests that the actress who played Edith Frank may have been a Nazi. Like, it's wild. There is a lot in this book that really shocked me, and I am somebody who is pretty well informed about this stuff. So highly recommend the book. It's not I had a really hard time with particularly the chapter about the camps. Again, it's like not new information to me, but I actually did learn a lot about the specifics of the camps that I hadn't known, particularly about like women's experiences. So this book is just fantastic. If you have ever had any feelings about Anne Frank, or if you've kind of like wondered why her diary has had such a legacy, I can't recommend it highly enough.
That sounds incredible, and also like I may not have the mental capacity for it right now. Spoiler. For our listeners don't actually know that I'm currently on maternity leave with a new baby, but it's one of those things that I'm going to file away for when my brain is more active, because that sounds really great.
Yes, it is. It is something that... you're not always in the mood for a Holocaust book, but if you feel ready for it, it's really fantastic.
In the meantime, there's YouTube comedy videos for you.
So true. All right. What a joy. Thanks for building community with me, guys. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening. And thanks to Adina Karp for editing our show. If you have a minute, it would be great if you could leave a review for us. We have two more episodes that we are planning to record, and we have ideas for them. But if you have questions for us or things you want us to talk about on the show, this is your very last chance to drop us a line, tamar.fox@gmail.com. You can also leave a comment on a post on our Facebook page or on our website, jpmedia.co. Just choose Talking and Shul from the list of podcasts. Please also donate to Jewish Public Media at jpmedia.co so we can continue to pay Adina for her important work. Zahava, what a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great.
Mimi, what a joy, even though we didn't get to do any dorky singing. Thank you so much.
Oh, anytime. Next one. Thank you.
All right. We will see you all next month.